Joint Committee of Ways and Means Subcommittee Natural Resource to order. And before I start, I'd like to welcome my shadow today, Thomas. And Thomas, help me out, I forgot your last name.
Ramsey.
And he wants to be a veterinarian, so it fits well in this committee.
Yeah.
And he's a pretty bright young man. I'm really impressed. He's from Lincoln City. And I assume you folks in the House have had, like we have in the Senate, many, many students from Lincoln County today. So welcome. Thomas has to leave at 1:30, so I told him to come down quick, and he'll see how we operate. So welcome. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5521. Staff, would you like to give us any updates and explain what we have here in front of us?
Certainly. One of the items you have in front of you is a memo from me on the possible performance measure for the mine land regulation and reclamation program to measure customer satisfaction. I've discussed this with the department, and they don't see any problem with implementing this kind of a customer satisfaction survey. It's a fairly standard format for measuring customer satisfaction. They can include a survey in their permits when they get renewals, and also a comment section to see if there's anything that maybe could be improved if there were some comments that weren't as good or very good.
Thank you. And let's see, let me refresh my memory. Do we have to ask the public as well?
Certainly, they can certainly have to provide any input, and we won't be dealing with this until work session, but
right.
I just thought
okay.
I would give it to the committee in case there were any questions or concerns. And I believe the department also should have at your place some other ideas for tracking public education, the public education side of the program one, which is the geologic survey, and they have some possible ideas for performance measurements on that developmental measure that you heard about yesterday. And then I believe where we left off yesterday was at budget and management description of the governor's budget.
Okay. Lisa, would you like to give us that presentation?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson, the Department of Administrative Services. And you should have a document that looks like this in front of you. Starting on page 2 of the document, there's a standard table showing the historical data for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries budget since the 1999 to 2001 biennium. And the data shows that the governor's proposed budget is a 9.5% increase from the 2001-03 biennium budget as of the fifth special session. General fund increase is 7%, and the vast majority of that increase is personal services roll-up. And as you may remember, for the natural resources area, because it was very late in the game, we did not remove the merit increases. Those were handled separately, not within the agency budget, but that will be taken care of later on. And then, of course, there were position actions, salary compensation plan changes that were incorporated partway during this current biennium and will be in effect for a full 24 months. And so there's some additional cost there in the next biennium. And that's the majority of that general fund change.
Lisa, if I could clarify for myself, probably a few others. And this is for you, I guess, Paul, but I think it's appropriate time to talk about it. We are supposed to take 4% after those merit pays have already been taken off. Is that right?
I believe so.
Is that what you understand, Susan? Okay. I wanted to make sure our whole committee understands that. Okay, thank you.
And then the only other important thing to note on that page is that federal funds increased by the greatest percentage, almost 20%. And that, of course, would be the largest driver for the overall total funds increase. If you turn to page 3, the slide shows the breakdown of the funding within the governor's budget. and the largest share belongs to the general fund, followed closely by other funds, and these include such things as fee revenues from fees on aggregate and mine permits, gas and oil fees, and contracts. The next largest share of funding comes from federal funds, and these are typically federal contracts, for example, with the Bonneville Power Administration, the U.S. Geological Survey, U.S. Forest Service, and the U.S. EPA. And then there's a small amount of other funds non-limited, and that comes from performance bonds or other securities that are required for deep oil, gas, and geothermal wells. And if there's a default on one of those, then that other funds non-limited comes into play to help reclaim a site. Turning to page four, this slide essentially summarizes the major points of the governor's proposed budget, and we'll get into more detail in later slides. As I mentioned before, the greatest increase came with federal funds, and that's the primary driver for the increase of total funds. Major changes approved by the legislature in the special sessions include the conversion of the Oregon Geology format or magazine to digital format, the closure of the publications warehouse, a reduction to a publications editor position, and a number of fund shifts, which we will be talking about in a moment. The major programs and services that are continued in the governor's proposed budget, essentially all of the programs except for what I just mentioned are continued, and so the geologic survey continues, regional and field geologists continue, statewide mapping continues, geohazards, information research, et cetera, work continues, and mine land reclamation continues. Turning to page five, this slide shows the relative size of each of the two programs that the agency operates, and as you can see, the geologic survey is by far the larger of the two. Going to page six, this slide shows that this agency's primary expenditure category is personal services, and the only other category is services and supplies. Turning to page seven, this slide shows that the development of the governor's budget, starting with the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget, which was the one that came out of the session in July of 2001. And that was about 8.1 million total funds. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002 were also incorporated, and these include the special session two actions, which reduced the director's out-of-state travel, converted the Oregon Geology magazine to a digital format, and shifted funding for coastal staff from general fund to other fund. There are base budget adjustments, which really is the personal services roll-up that I just mentioned, and that will be adjusted later on. Essential packages include the traditional inflationary packages. Again, this agency, like all other natural resource agencies, was not affected by the exclusion of inflation as it was in the large general fund areas because of timing and the need to get the budget to the printer. The inflation affected temporary positions and mass transit, and also it would affect services and supplies, all services and supplies, travel, and rent, et cetera. There were some phase-ins from the second special session. There were some temporary reductions that were phased back in, and these include executive sabbaticals, the incentive program, accounting agreements, in-state travel, out-of-state travel, administrative travel, and field staff non-project travel. Turning to page 8.
Question from Representative Johnson.
Could you give us a little additional detail on the executive sabbatical?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, one of the recommendations or one of the pieces of the agency's plan for the second special session reductions was to have the deputy director and the director take some time off and work on essentially, I believe it would be contract basis. And what happened was that was accepted. And in implementing it, the deputy director was reduced by 0.25 FTE. And then that was restored. And it was intended to be a short-term kind of reduction, and it has in fact been implemented. And is there anything else?
I just want to make sure I understand it. This was a cost-saving measure recommended by the agency during special session two. That it's just the word sabbatical that I think is confusing. Some of us think of sabbatical in another context, that's paid work away from the job to pursue a period of refreshment for executives, and they're paid to do that and then come back. This was really a cost-saving measure that ended up then being reversed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. Sabbatical is typically, as you know, an education-based term, and it didn't actually work out to be a sabbatical at all. It was really a reduction in FTE with some time off for that person.
Good. I just want to get on the record exactly what that we're not mischaracterizing what was a voluntary cost saving.
Right. Turning to page 8, this slide shows the policy packages, starting with the policy package for the third special session. And that includes the adjustments for salaries for salary range 38 and above. It also included some fund shifts, again, for coastal expenditures from general fund to other fund. And it included another reduction to the publications editor position. I need to mention here that with package 81 and package 91, the plan that was developed to create these reductions didn't work precisely as intended when it was actually put into the position information control system. And that has created some problems, and we've discussed this with legislative fiscal, and so some adjustments will need to be made. Specifically on this package 081, there was no reduction in FTE. But there would need to be in order to actually generate the savings. So we have temporarily entered some adjustments into the system in order to achieve the target, but there will need to be some changes later on. The 082 package is the special section 1 changes, and that was intended to shift positions, again, from general fund to other fund. Again, there were some issues putting it into the system and actually being able to generate the dollars, because the fund shifts were quite complicated and involved a number of positions, and it just didn't work out quite the way it was intended. So, again, that one will be looked at and brought back to you later on with maybe an alternative suggestion to get to the same dollars. The 090 package actually brings back some of those reductions that were short-term from the second special session that I mentioned previously, and those would be the computer upgrade, the out-of-state travel, and the non-fixed, non-specified services and supplies reductions. And then the 091 package, which was the fifth special session, section 2, which just took effect February 1st, again involved fund shifting. Again, it didn't quite work out as intended in the system, and so again, we will be bringing something back to you with legislative fiscal in order to achieve those dollars. That brings us to fee or revenue changes. The agency has requested through House Bill 2256 a mined land reclamation fee change. It's intended to bring in about $121,000 in the next biennium. And I'm sure that they will be happy to talk about that further, but it would enable them to fill some vacant positions. And that is supported by the governor in this budget. And with that, that's an overview of the governor's proposed budget for the 2003-05 biennium. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Lisa. Yes, Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on the page 4, you got shifting funding on positions from general fund to other funds. What are those other funds? And those increased federal funds that are talked about above that, do you expect that to continue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the agency, and I can call or ask Dr. Bolio to come up here and confirm this, the agency has been working on obtaining essentially contract work, and we had a lot of discussion during budget development as to whether or not that was going to continue and be available. At the time, they felt that it was pretty solid. They may have changed their assessment in the past 2 or 3 months. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Bolio.
Thank you.
Fine presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Bolio, state geologist, and we're addressing the issue of the other funds and federal funds and the fund shifts. As Lisa pointed out, the mechanics of getting various positions moved around and during the governor's balanced budget preparation didn't work out. It was fairly ornate strategy in terms of the format we could work with, and the timing was very short. A bunch of good people worked hard together, and we have some unfinished business in the details. But in answering your question, the other funds and the federal funds that are in the governor's balanced budget, if they're applied to the proper positions, which is the trick here, we think we can make that work. And so, as I mentioned yesterday, we can do projections into the future several years with certain levels of certainty, and I'm reasonably certain that we can make the make those changes, make those revenue shifts. We have multiple year commitments out of several agencies for those specific positions, one of them being the second position on the coastal program and another one being the second position in the hazard program. If those fund shifts are applied to other positions, then they don't work because those other positions don't use the kinds of funds that are that we're targeting. And this is why we have to take not only the numbers and have those work, but they have to be applied to the positions that are able to capture and use the funding, and that's the difficulty that we're dealing with. That help?
That helps. Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's something both appealing and unsettling about the way that you've got some of these positions paid for. Appealing in that I appreciate the sort of entrepreneurial spirit among you and your staff of getting the work done and we'll figure out a way to get it paid for. Unsettling in that we sat right there, I did, in the same room this morning and listened to DAS make a presentation about risk management and about the possibility of employee lawsuits and the other difficulties that face DAS in trying to have agencies conform to best business practices. And it seems to me that there's sort of a disconnect between this entrepreneurial little agency that's doing the best it can to figure out all sorts of sources of funds to get the job done, and a kind of best business practices that says you potentially put employees at risk in terms of being able to honor the commitments that are made to them. You put program at risk. You put customer at risk by having a financing situation that we're being asked to give approval to that seems sort of tenuous. And I guess I'm looking for some level of reassurance that this is employing the best kind of business practice with which to do the public's work and expend the public's money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm pleased to address your question. It's a difficult question, and in terms of risk management, in terms of this kind of risk management, what we've been trying to manage over the last 10 or 20 years has been a migration of the agency towards soft money. And so the question has to be, when are you maxed out in that area? That's addressed by what money's out there that's available, addressed by the skill level and the specialties of your people, and it's addressed by the needs of the state. Now, in the case of our department, the needs of the state that have evolved in the last 15 years on any scale have been off the charts, both in terms of the geology needed to address water issues and in terms of the very large-scale risk we have from the standpoint of geologic hazards, including earthquakes and landslides. And these have been laid by statute on our agency, and we've been doing the best we can. Now, looking to the future, when I took this job, I recognized immediately the need to somehow come to grips with the issue you've just raised. And as I pointed out yesterday in introductions, I pursued a variety of fronts, and one of them was to get an ability to project the future, what our revenues would be, and which funding sources were reliable, and which ones presented what we call our arteries. They're the main funding. And so the initial projection that we have for the next 2.5 years balances out at $1.43 million of soft money that I feel somewhat confident about, reasonably confident. And in the budget for soft money, you have $1.42 million if you keep the editor position vacant, which is what's evolving here in the budget process. So I'm confident, but at the same time I'm confident, I also started to touch yesterday on the subject that our back is to the wall and we're at the point of imploding if we cut any farther. And that's something that's going to obviously be discussed later today and maybe in a work session later, and I just simply have to point that out. Our backs are against the wall on this. And when something does go, this construction, which is half cards and half real, starts to fall apart faster than the cuts are made. Because you take out one person, you take out the contract that they brought in, and you probably take out some other things as well. So we're stressed, but I'm confident with the governor's balanced budget.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? And I'm about to head into controversial territory. You said in your remarks just a second ago that work had been laid onto the agency by statute, and I appreciate how that happens. One thing that I haven't seen is much of an enthusiasm on the part of agencies to perhaps revisit statutory requirements that have been laid on them over years. And I'm thinking especially now of Oregon Economic and Community Development. If you look at their statutes, they take pages. And it has seemed to me an obligation of the agency at some point to look at them and say, we can't discharge these, we're doing a poor job on doing these, this is no longer relevant, and I'm making this stuff up. But I'm just saying, an enthusiasm on the part of agencies to say succeeding legislatures for decades maybe have put requirements on us, and we'd like to come in and revisit our statutory requirements. And here's the controversial piece. Are we, as a legislature at this point, asking you to do work that maybe has questionable efficacy? I don't discount, for example, the devastation that could be wrought by a tsunami, but spending a huge amount of money worrying about something that happens every 500 years or however often it is, have you as an agency, given the precarious nature of your funding and your migration to soft money, looked at those statutory requirements and said, we're not being served very well by this work, could you, legislature, relieve us of this obligation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, again, you don't know how pleased I am to address this issue with you. Regarding the evolution of the department, during the last 10 years, as I indicated yesterday, we had a revision of the statutes for the department in 89, 91, and 93. And those revisions were designed specifically to address these hazards for Oregon and the mapping needs that simply could not be avoided. It's kind of like nature drove the legislature to recognize the value of the department. We also concurrently came in with a variety of changes, both in our budget and in the statutes. We eliminated our rock laboratory, for example, which was two or three employees and maybe 10 or 15% of our budget back in 91. We no longer have an economic minerals person, an economist, and there are several other things. If you were to look at the number of people in our department today, let's say 38, and then the number that we had, say, 15 or 20 years ago, the number doesn't change that much, but every single person we have today is doing something different than we did 20 years ago. So we've shed a lot of weight along the way as we've tried to keep pace with the issues. And part of the risk management issue is, I do agree with your statements. We just came out of a strategic planning process that says, how are we going to deal with this? And it's not like prior strategic plans. This one actually says we're going to go after partnerships where we can. We're going to skip things where we have to. And if you go to the statute that was handed out yesterday and read all of the stuff that we're supposed to be doing, there's a lot of it in there. We aren't doing it. We don't have there's a whole list of do this. Geodetic survey, which is absolutely essential. We aren't doing it. We're relying on others. Volcanoes, we aren't doing it. All we're doing is covering the trails of others who are doing they're communicating to various communities in the state, but they're not doing the job we think they should be doing, so we might appear at a meeting now and then. We're just leaving that to the USGS. But there's a lot of stuff we're not doing. Now, my message to you as a committee is that we're stressed after we have shed all the things that we think we responsibly can, but still there are some things that are so compelling in this state, at this time, in the area of geology, we're still trying to scratch by and get those done. And that's where we are. That's where we think we are with that issue.
One last. Does the tsunami work fall into that compelling category?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the tsunami work is funded by the federal government on a five-state cooperative basis, which at international levels is used to help all the countries of the Pacific Rim. But that is not our money in the sense that it's a general fund. That is federal money that we are using in part to backfill one of the positions in the Coastal Field Office. And so I'm well aware of the commentary on the radio this morning, and I'm well aware of what appeared in the paper the other day. And all I can say is we are managing that program with a risk management approach. We're not out there rebuilding the world. We're simply putting out brochures with federal money. We're coordinating with federal money. And we're trying to implement Senate Bill 379 of 1995, which said there's a line west of which there will be no schools, no hospitals, or no anything else of that type unless there's some compelling reason why it has to be there. We're simply trying to implement that statute. And again, it's federal money, and we're being very, very careful how we design the program to be cost-effective.
One last one, Mr. Chair. You talked about the partnerships, and I applaud that, but just when you mentioned the line beyond which there shouldn't be hospitals or schools, to the degree that you're trying to run a land use program, what help do you get from those agencies charged with land use planning? And I'm thinking, again, how much interagency collaboration is there on, say, aggregate resource? It was over my howling objections that ODOT added a aggregate position to the tune of $169,000 a biennium to simply write down all their sites. I mean, that just seemed to me an extraordinary luxury in the approaching budget crisis. Reassure me that there is collaboration between the agencies so that you're not doing your land use planning in a little silo and ODOT doing their rock work in a little silo, and that you're sharing that information.
Could I approach this in pieces? Several questions there, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. On the tsunami issue, we aren't doing land use planning. In fact, when that bill was written, it was specifically written to not be a land use statute, but rather a building code statute. Building codes implements the prohibitions. The only role we have now is if a person comes in and says, we think there are technical reasons for an exception, they have a place to go for that. The policy is already in place. Now, in terms of coordination, we have joint workshops with LCDC and building codes. We have joint working together on some hazard committees in the state that involve both cities and the various state agencies. We developed on the national level with the Institute of Business and Home Safety a showcase state recognition for the state, and the governor recognized that, and that provides for and requires the kind of coordination you're talking about. When the executive order was written and it had us and emergency management both implementing the executive order, that was so new as a joint executive order responsibility, legal counsel in the governor's office for a while refused to even put it on the street. And we told them, this is about people working together, there should be joint signatures, and they put it on the street. So for tsunamis, we're carrying a small piece of the load, and we're doing it with federal funding, and we think we've designed a program that is very effective and not intrusive into people's lives, and it's kind of evolving a state awareness that's quite useful. On the aggregate side, I've forgotten some of your questions. I think the broadest response back, though, is that for the land use part of it, we don't do that. Local government makes a land use siting decision on aggregate sites. After they have done that, the permit comes to us, or the application comes to us for the technical side that basically says, since local government has approved this site, how are they going to do it so that it meets the environmental and the reclamation requirements of local government? So we do coordinate with local government, but we are not we do not make that land use decision. They make it. In terms of the aggregate positions around the state in various places, I heard your comments yesterday, and I can't respond to all of your concerns. I guess I don't know what they all are, but I do know that aggregate issues are so contentious and so interwoven with so many aspects of society that it doesn't surprise me that more than one agency is involved. Our involvement is the reclamation of the whole the proper construction and sequencing of the whole, and the coordination of the natural resource part of things among the other agencies that are involved. And we are not part of the asset management function that ODOT has evolved for itself, and we are not doing the Goal 5 stuff or the land use stuff that LCDC is weaving in and out of view on with the aggregate position that they have. Last session, this particular biennium, through a very stressed set of discussions, we did help fund one-fourth of that position, but only on the contingency that LCDC would provide us with more than that amount of money for coastal hazard assessment work out of their federal money there. So we made a net gain on that financially, and I think it was kind of a win-win for both agencies. We are not offering that kind of money next biennium under any conditions. We simply don't have it.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that as we discuss this agency, one of the things that we have to bear in mind is that we have gone over this budget for several bienniums now with trying to save money as being our primary consideration. And this agency is really lean and mean. There isn't, as you can see, a lot to cut. And the way that they've managed to save the positions is to weave several different kinds of funding through a lot of the different positions. So if you knock out one of the funding sources, you knock out pieces of a bunch of the positions, and it becomes real problematic how you put it all back together again and have it function. And when I chaired the committee in the last session, and we kind of saw the writing on the wall about the situation with general fund, and had the kind of nebulous foreboding of what we were going to be facing, having no idea that what we were really facing was way worse than what we thought we were going to be facing, we worked to try to, again, make economies in the general fund side of this. And now we're in a place where we're in far worse a place than we ever thought we'd be. And again, we have to make general fund economies in this. And so it's going to be very difficult. And so where I want to take this is that the department has a fee bill, House Bill 2256, on the table. And what I'd like to do, if you would indulge me, Mr. Chair, is to have them talk to us about how that's made up and where the money is coming from and what it will do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think in the interest of simplicity and consistency, it's probably best if Gary Lynch responds to those types of questions since he's carrying that bill.
Why don't you just stay there, John? And Gary, go ahead and bring a chair up. We're probably going to have more questions.
Mr. Chair. While they're trading out folks, I just would like to respond to my colleague, Representative Morgan, by saying I agree with everything you've said. I just want to make sure that we're not incentivizing agency behavior that so interweaves different sources of funds that the budgets then become bulletproof at a later point in time. I appreciate and acknowledge the entrepreneurial spirit that has cobbled this agency together. But there may be a best business practices lesson here.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, just to kind of lay another card here on the table, the aggregate issues are huge in terms of their economic impact on the state, pulling people, getting ourselves out of this mess that we're in financially. And I think that all of us recognize that rock's the basis of about everything that we build. And if we don't have rock, we can't build the roads, we can't build the buildings, we just can't move forward on a lot of on-the-ground projects that put people to work and put people to work in jobs that pay good wages. And there are areas of the state where this is a huge problem. Down in the part of the world where I live, and I know in a lot of the coastal communities, with our ability to take aggregate out of the rivers and the streams being completely really impacted by the endangered species issues and the clean water issues, the aggregate issues that are in the riparian area become hugely important in terms of economic development. And I just like to lay that on the table because I think that it is critical, not just from the point of view of the fiscal soundness of the agency, but it's critical in terms of us trying to do the best job that we can to allow private industry to get the economy of the state back online, that we seriously consider the issues that are coming to the table with trying to get the aggregate sites ready to actually be used. And the issues are in the land use planning arena, and they're in the Endangered Species Act and the clean water arena, and they're in the interface with the Corps of Engineers over the fill and removal issues. So with that...
Really, if you can be real short, I do want to get some... statements on the record today, and we do have some sign-ups for the public input as well, and I have a list of questions.
I'll just summarize by saying you had me, Representative Morgan, right up to that point, and you and I might just choose to disagree. I come from one of those counties that is one of the great rock pits of Oregon, and there have been abuses, there have been problems, so we may just agree to disagree.
Well, I'm not going to deny that going back in time you can find bad actors, because I think you can in about everything that you look at. But, you know, just to kind of bear in mind that there are real economic development issues.
Okay. Gary?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I'm the Director of the Mine Land Reclamation Program. And just so I understand, the question is, how did we come up with the fee increase? Or
talk to us about what the fee bill is all about, how you got to the bill, what it does, and what it will allow the department to do.
I think as we all understand here, mining is a very polarizing industry. And it always has been, and it always will be. And really what we're talking about here is how do we have our cake and eat it too. The purpose of the fee bill is to restore a staff position that we currently have authorization for. We started working with the industry at the end of last session, where we talked about this in ways and means, is how do we make sure we have a narrow gap between the fees the industry pays and how much of that entrepreneurial spirit we have to go out and gather grants and that type of thing. And I might add, and I hope this is accepted well, the one county we don't work in is Columbia County. Anyway, so that fee bill is designed to restore that position. The importance of that, that ultimately saves money in the long run, because what it does is it prevents, it produces field-based solutions where we go and we work with operators. We have 870 of them. We have 870 pits approximately. We check that monthly, but that's where we are today. And the key is they pay us renewal fees every year. I've been doing this for 22 years. I started at the bottom doing those field inspections. And what I realized, if you go to your permittees and you talk to them so that they understand what your expectations are, and your and the field staff understand what the requirements how hard you have to work to produce rock. It is not an easy job, and mistakes are made. There are some people who are marginal, there are some people who are great, and there's a whole bunch in between. If we go out there and we work with those people, we end up with very, very few enforcement actions, and we'll always have some disputes. But we believe it's the key is having field people to go to these sites and make sure that expectations are understood. We can take advantage of topography or whatever it is so that they produce the rock they need, which, in Senator Representative Morgan is correct, it is a base natural resource for the construction industry and road building. And in my opinion, we tend to see, as the economy turns down, we tend to see a decrease in production, and it's the one of the first things to turn around when the economy goes up, because it is a base resource. The fee increase is somewhat elaborate in the sense that we have, of those 870 sites, 400 of them produced no rock last year. So how do we can't just load that fee increase onto them across the board and expect them to be able to maintain business. So they, and by the way, currently, the last time I talked with the substantive committee on this increase, we're now down to 3/4 of the fee increase. But I'm going to talk.
Explain that, Gary.
Only that the bill did not come out of committee yet. And when I met with the chair of the committee, he said, "Could you take less money?" And I said, "Well, some is better than none." But at the point that it doesn't allow us to fill that position, then we haven't gained anything. So I'm not trying to speak for the committee chair here. I said I thought we could possibly we bring this in as an entry-level position that we could get by with 3/4 of the revenues. And I'm really trying to talk about how to reconstruct this right now, which is we had at the 100% level, we had $35 per renewal fee on existing sites. That way, the small folks in Eastern Oregon who produce once every 4 years and once every 10 years can afford to keep that permit, hopefully. At the same time, then, and we know there is a strong correlation between the size of the mine and the amount of work it requires us to do. And so you see that in increments of, I don't have the increments exactly, but they start at 10,000 yards per year on up to 1.5 million yards per year, the renewal fee increases. In addition, we increase the fee on applications from $875 to $1,200. We tend to be able to process those permits very quickly, relatively quickly, and feel that covers the cost of processing that permit for the most part. The part here that I think goes a long way into helping the state ultimately save money is one of the things we have recognized for a long time. And as I think most of you know, many of the Goal 5 hearings get extremely contentious, and understandably so. There are opponents and there are proponents. One of the things that we worked with the industry and their suggestion, and I agree with it, is that we will, although we're not required by law to go to these hearings, because there isn't a direct link between the land use process and the mine land reclamation process, we said it just makes sense for us to go to those hearings and at least explain what reclamation can do. It is designed to restore the secondary beneficial use that the county or the land use planning authority decides is acceptable for that piece of parcel of land. The third area where we have worked very hard. As a result of the 96-97 floods, we understood just how susceptible these pits are to capture by a river and some of the devastating effects that can have. The state of Washington, for the most part, chose to say, let's just not mine there. We said, that, in our opinion, that was an easy way out and not necessarily the most scientific, not done with the most scientific understanding. We have said, there is a real opportunity on the floodplain. And yesterday I explained a little bit about the Rogue River. And those are sites that were permitted or grandfathered from regulation. And again, those were decisions were made 30 years ago, and everybody's changed since then. But in our new permits, we are working with all natural resource agencies, including particularly ODF&W, DSL, and others, to ensure that when that secondary beneficial use goes into effect, we now not only have the rock that came out of it, but safety for that pit won't be captured, but in a new way, not by building an abutment the length of the river, creating an artificial channel, but allowing those waters to come in and provide refuge for juvenile salmonids. Am I off to... let me end there, because I think I probably strayed from the fact, but where I was getting at is fees allow us to stay in that arena, and it's vital that we do stay in that arena, because in that staff position allows us, those fees allow us to bring the staff position in that keeps our inspection level up, which is important, because that's where we're eyeball to eyeball with all these folks. It allows us to go to the public hearings and explain what we do, and it allows us to continue on in the floodplain, all with one position, because it is interwoven amongst all our staff.
Let me ask you, could you give us a brief report on, are the stakeholders on board? repairs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've talked. ODOT is our, I think, probably has more permits with us than anyone, and they're fine with it. And I don't want to speak for the aggregate industry, but I know they have testified to the effect that the OCAPA board voted unanimously to support the fee increase.
And they're here today, and we'll get them on the record as well. So.
They are.
Okay. Yes, Senator.
You have a fee bill that funds one position? I never heard of a fee bill that only funds one position before, Mr. Chair. In its introduced form, how much money does it raise?
Over the course of the biennium, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, if implemented at 100% of what we propose, it would produce $120,000 over the course of the biennium. And that includes about $15,000 for service and supplies and $105,000 basically for the position.
It doesn't sound like a big fee bill. I mean, if you've got 870 pits, and I don't know, the application fee, is that an annual fee? That's not an annual fee.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, there's an application fee that is proposed to go from $875
right.
to $1,200, and then there is a renewal fee paid yearly, and that's
but
where
the application fee is just if I want to mine an area and I get through all of the early hoops, then I come to you and would pay you $1,200 as a one-time fee? Is that...
Mr. Chairman, just so, and Senator Dukes, just so there's no misunderstanding here, the application fee is the first year. If they have land use approval, then they come to us and they give us a fee of $1,200. We process the application, we do an inspection, we set the bond, we confirm the reclamation plan, and then every year after that, they pay a renewal fee. And depending on the amount of production from the previous year, that sets what the renewal fee is, and that can change. That changes based on production.
I just want to make one comment. I'm probably stepping out of line here a little bit, but you've got my attention, Mr. Lynch, when you stated that you were negotiating with the policy committee over the fee rate. I think that's what you're alluding to. And no disregard or disrespect to your comment, but I will be talking to the leadership of this body on both sides of the end of the building. That is a ways and means issue. And I personally feel very strongly that is not a point of discussion for the policy committees. And so hopefully we can help clarify that in your endeavors. We're the ones that are responsible for balancing your budget, and we're the ones that should be involved in setting the amount of the fee increase if they send the bill down to us. So hope that is helpful. Representative Johnson, I've got several questions that I want to ask after you've finished with your question, Representative Johnson, and then I do want to have some time for the public comments. And then if we have more time left before 3 o'clock, we'll come back to the committee's questions. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to say I agree with you completely on the issue of the fee, and I support you advocating that that's a ways and means issue. You make a very compelling case for the fee increase. The only question that I have that I need some further clarification, if I understood you, you said that it was going to require Dogami to go to the local land use process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it won't require it. It is an understanding that that's, if we have staff resources, one of the best places we can put, and clearly I think as you recognize my testimony yesterday, we have currently 4.5 field people. This will give us 5.5. Everybody does multiple things. We divide the state up so that each reclamation has certain counties. We've recognized for a long time that it's a priority to go to these Goal 5 hearings so that at least the county commissioners and the land use people understand what reclamation can do. By giving us this extra person, we can go to more of those, and that's good. It's not a statutory requirement.
I'm going to become very concerned if Dogami's presence at those local hearings turns out to be an advocacy role, because if you are there to provide information to local decision-makers about the benefits of reclamation, that's a very good thing. If your presence, state presence, is perceived as advocacy for permitting, that's a very bad thing. And I think in my experience, local folks have had a tendency to see the state arrive and base decisions on your input and presence. And if that slips over into advocacy, I think that's a slippery slope.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, this is an important point. We actually at one point, and we probably still do, have the authority to charge the applicant for our presence at those hearings. And just because of what you say, we have chosen not to do that. We go there to let them know what reclamation can do. I can't say that at every hearing everybody leaves thinking that we weren't. The opponents will think we're probably an advocate of the industry, and the industry probably thinks we're an opponent of the industry. It is a slippery slope, and it takes. We have to be very careful in that arena, and I understand what you're saying.
If I might just interject, too, I think that part of the job that we have as representatives is to kind of monitor that situation.
I want to try to move this part of the hearing into specifically how we're going to deal with the parameters that we have to deal with here. So I have several questions, and if you could bear with me here. Now, the first question is in regards to the Northwest Center, and there was discussion, I understand, at the last 2 years ago about the to investigate the publication and service prices and the potential for revenue increases. The question is, how is the center's staff funded, I guess, would be part of that question, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll ask you to listen very carefully to what I'm going to say because it's easily misunderstood. The center staff consists of 12 individuals. 10 of them are volunteers. One of them is given to us by the U.S. Forest Service, and the 12th one is a public information person who dedicates half of his time to actually selling something over the counter and another half to answering questions to keep those people away from the professionals, which is a more expensive way to answer questions. Now, the part of that person who is dedicated to the sales is paid for by the sales. So this is a balanced budget operation, but when you look at it, it's a very large one because well over 90% of what you see there is either volunteer or paid for by an agency other than my department. We also are a distributor of publications for about 12 agencies who basically see the advantage of just having us do that for them. So visually, it's very misleading, but that's how it's taken care of. Now, in terms of the pricing of documents, we ran a repricing of documents about a year ago, and we also put them all on disk, so they all have a new price anyway, because on disk you charge different than when it's on paper. So we've done all of that, and I mentioned yesterday that we can't necessarily price too high, or the guy across the street's going to undercut us, which is fine. They've done that before. But it also violates a whole variety of executive orders and legislative directives elsewhere that say we're trying to get information to people. The state does not need. There are already 500 bookstores in Portland. We don't need another one. This is more of an information center where we get cost reimbursement.
Okay.
And we sell things that don't sell anywhere else.
Second question is regards to mine land reclamation program. Support of agency administration. How is the program charged for its share of the administration cost? We'll just answer that one first, I guess.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for all non-general fund activities, we negotiate with a federal cognizant agency as to what, in accounting terms, is a proper administrative charge. That charge varies between 17.3 or 17.4%. We apply that to all non-general fund activities, including the MLR program. So the charge that we apply to mine land reclamation is the same as anything else. Now, I would go on to say that if there is a fee increase, our plan is to not be charging more because it becomes too large a number in terms of the number of staff that we're administering for. So we've made exceptions here and there to capture federal contracts. It would be excessive to take the fee increase for which you've negotiated numbers to hire staff and then turn around and take some of that money to pay for something in Portland when, in fact, there was no increase in workload there. So the number in our budget is $171,000, and we would propose to keep it there with or without the fee increase.
And does that hold true for the the director's position as well? Is that 17% pay part of the director's fee too?
The 17% pays, it depends on where you, it pays part of this, the rightmost section, of the TAN sections, the one to the right is something we call management and internal services. The actual dollars themselves, if you were to put a flag on them, pay for half of the business manager, half of the accountant, and then a pro rata share of rent, lights, agency assessments to DAS and whatever. So they pay for administration, but in the budget structure, they do not technically pay for the director.
Wouldn't that make sense that they should pay a portion of your oversight management fees?
Well, within the numerator of the calculation for indirect costs, any particular element in that numerator can be paid for with that. I would submit that if we were to move the dollars over, then it would leave a hole somewhere else. It's interesting that indirect costs were first applied to our agency in the MLR program back in 1975, I believe it was, at the insistence of the industry. And at a later time, the legislature addressed the issue, and they did not want the director's salary to be tied directly to that money because they did not want him tied in any way, shape, or form to the favor of the industry in making decisions.
Okay. Third question. Do any of the GS offices house the MLR positions?
Our Albany office is the one where the MLR is. It is centrally located for quick travel anywhere in the state. If you look at a road map, none of the MLR positions are in any of the other field offices.
Related to that, if a field office were closed, which office would you recommend if we got to that point?
If I could work my way through some criteria. If you were to close a field office, I could give you very compelling reasons why, of course, I'd like to see that happen to none of them, because it would probably force the closure of another office, given the way the contracts are structured with the federal government. I would argue it would have to end up being either the Grants Pass or the Baker Field Office. I have information here that responds to many of the issues you brought up yesterday. That might maybe help put that in context. I could hand that stuff out to you. You had asked that question, but a lot of other questions about criteria and everything else, and I would like to have the opportunity to at least distribute the material so you can be looking at it. Could I continue with this line of information, taking about 2 minutes?
Let me finish my list here, and then maybe you can get them all together. Is it true that all administrative costs are in your highest priority?
To keep?
In your highest priority, yes.
Yes.
And if you reduce other programs or staff, how do you justify that?
If there were a reduction of, say, one section, the impact it has on, I responded to that question to Paul. He asked that kind of general question. The costs that are in administration are the director and the deputy director and the business officer who oversees the contracts and the personnel. So that's a very thin structure, just a couple of people doing this work. And you have to begin trimming quite a few things before you reduce the workload to the point that you would lose a person in the management section. The other costs, which I call internal services, are things like, there's a lot of common costs in there. There's stuff that if a field office does not manage that cost, we do not assign the cost to them to manage. So you'll find things like the light bills and the rent
and the AG bills and whatever, those are all clustered in management. But if you go into management looking for a slush fund, it isn't in there. Now, if we remove a field office, that's two out of our 38 staff, I would presume that our assessments by DAS would go down by 2/38. So if you pursue that kind of logic through the system, then there probably is some kind of pro rata reduction based on however those bills are built when they come to us. You know, whatever the number would be, and I don't know how some of those assessments are even put together. But, you know, if we crank out less paper, have a slightly cheaper audit, a few things like that, somewhere near there's a savings.
Well, I appreciate your allowing me to ask some very direct questions, but I did want to get that on the record.
I think you've answered my questions.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Sure.
You had 9 points you brought up yesterday. I've prepared a handout. I can cover the whole thing in less than a minute.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Well, we might have more time afterwards. Okay. I've got 4 people signed up, and if we have more time after, go ahead and deal with it right now, because
I give them all this. Okay, in terms of reclasses, we don't propose any that would require legislative attention.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dukes.
Did you have any during the interim?
We probably had about 10.
During the interim?
Yes. What I've been doing is trying to mold the agency around this organization chart, and various positions have gone up or down, but I've done them all with internal adjustments. If I have a vacant position, I...
Okay, that's all nice, but it all adds up to money on the budget.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Well, it all rolls up, whereas a vacant position wouldn't have rolled up if we hadn't used the money. I'm just concerned that they happened during the interim and not during the regular budget process. Mr. Chair, I'd like to see a copy of all of those.
No, it's not.
No, because it's all 103.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, the instructions I've always received are to try to accommodate reclasses internally without bringing them to the legislature, because what you're
those
doing...
Those aren't the legislature's rules.
Okay. We will provide you with a pile of paper. Okay.
Okay.
Charles, you know that. Okay.
And any help, Mr. Chair? Because they're all supposed to go through the DAS. I know from past experience the DAS doesn't always give them a whole lot of overlook, so any information that DAS might have on those reclasses would be helpful as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, they all went to DAS.
Yeah, it's just that somehow
they only pay attention to some of them and the rest of them they just sort of...
A third of the agency.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Senator, when I say a dozen, it might have been over the last 4 years, as I think
I'm
about
just
it.
Talking about the last...
This biennium?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. We did have an outline for testimony. You have that in your packets. There was a question about how various agencies compare state to state. You have that under tab 5 in your packet.
Thank you.
Regarding vacancies, we have 3. They're all of other funds. One is involving with the fee increase that we talked about. Second one is in a field office. Third one, which is the editor position, which is basically eliminated in the governor's budget. None of them are general fund. Management ratios vary on how you want to do your calculations, either something between 7-1 and 17-1, depending on definitions. Criteria for reduction are best presented in our 30% reduction plan, which you've been provided with. You've also been provided with a 30% reduction plan with a 100% cut list, which is in tab 6. Also, with this handout you just received is a bulleted analysis of each of our sections and a few other financial observations about the department. There's my 2 minutes.
All right.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Dukes.
Back on the reclassifications, I noticed that what we've just been handed out says that you don't have any at this time, but may need to develop some reclassifications with internal offsets to resolve routine emerging personnel matters. The reason we get excited about them is mostly because we tend to think that we give you your structure as to what your agency is going to look like. And then if you go sort of shift the structure on us, we're often surprised when you come back the next time around. So if you can foresee any reclassifications for this current biennium that may come down, I mean, I can fully appreciate the need sometimes to restructure an agency, but we'd sort of like to be part of that, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the restructuring that you see on the chart
to my left was one that was imposed upon me by the last session of Ways and Means, and the reordering of the positions, which I did, was designed to be cost neutral. But I did, and when I look ahead to the next biennium, I'm anticipating personnel actions where certain people grieve their workload, and I now have to solve it. I'm not anticipating anything that I would initiate. I'm anticipating reaction to possible grievances.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that and I understand it. However, you may find this committee telling you that if they're grieving their workload because it's evolved, that it ought to re-evolve back to where it started out to be, and they ought to be carrying a lower workload rather than getting a reclass. Given the times, it's so tough. So I'm just saying that we may help you with some of those, but we'd need to know about them ahead of time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jukes, we always welcome your assistance.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
He said through grit and teeth.
Okay, thank you very much, and we might, if we have more time, we'll call you back up.
I'd like to call Marshall Koba.
Go ahead. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Marshall Koba, and I'm representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon and the coalition of supporters of ballot measures 15 and 16 from the November 2002 general election. We are here today to support the funding for the studies that are the initial phase of the process for measures 15 and 16 and in the legislation that was passed last session would be administered through DOGAMI. And in the back of the packet that I handed you, I have highlighted the Senate Bill 15 and 14, and it talks about the study portion, and I've highlighted these FEMA studies. Under the banner of Oregonians for Safer Buildings, the coalition was successful in educating Oregonians about the very real earthquake danger we have in this state, and the coalition includes representatives of hospitals, schools, local governments, firefighters, steelworkers, building trades, other unions, and others committed to the promise of safer buildings that was supported by voters across the state. These measures were the work product of the Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee, and we'd like to thank Senator Courtney and others who served on this committee and had the foresight to develop this legislation. The committee developed these innovative measures after many years of inquiry regarding the potential for significant earthquakes in Oregon. Experts agree Oregon has had and is expected to have major earthquakes that, when they happen, could have a devastating impact on our economy and standard of living for many years following the event. The coalition understands the very real limitation on budget matters this session. We also understand the very real consequences of an earthquake that could hit the region at any time. We believe that with the strong support of Oregon voters, this committee has the mandate to begin a process that will have a very important role in our ability, when a major event happens, to keep Oregon economically and socially viable. These measures are important for our future, and we encourage your enthusiastic support. With me today is Ray Miller. Ray is the principal of Miller Consulting Engineers in Portland, and he's been very active in the engineering profession and has served several years on the State Building Code Board, and he will present an outline for the funding and the duties required to begin implementation of these measures. Thank you.
Thank you. Miller?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Ray Miller, President and CEO of Miller Consulting Engineers of Portland. I've been a professional engineer since 1965. I've built a business that currently employs 21 personnel specialized in structural design as either prime contractor or subcontractor with a commitment to partnering and value engineering. My firm has the pleasure of being the prime contractor on the State Capitol Building seismic upgrade following the spring break quake of 1993. Today I'm representing the American Council of Engineering Companies, Oregon's chapter, as well as the Structural Engineers Association of Oregon. I am here today to present a proposal for the initial funding to begin the preliminary study requirements as dictated by ballot measures 15 and 16. As required by the measures, the first step towards a seismic upgrade of schools, hospitals, fire stations, police stations, and other essential facilities is to conduct an inventory of these buildings in Oregon and determine what degree they are able to withstand a seismic event of varying magnitudes. As outlined in the measure, this funding is to be administered by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and it is important we all understand This is the first step in a series of events that will, once completed, make our schools and essential facility safer for Oregonians. Today we propose a preliminary budget of $1.4 million to fund the first phase of the project. If the first phase inventory, as outlined in Majors 15 and 16, is completed prior to the 2005 legislative session, we will be able to move forward towards the important bonding package to actually begin the reinforcement retrofitting of buildings. Enclosed is a breakdown of how the money will be used. The GAMI estimates that there are approximately 4,000 buildings to be reviewed in the state that fall under the required criteria. The first step will be to complete by 2005 this inventory, at which point we will inform the public about the conditions of our schools, hospitals, and public safety buildings, and how we can move forward to prepare for a more seismic secure future. I have developed the following preliminary budget figures with the input from other engineering professionals. We have relied upon data supplied by DeGami on our and our professional experience. Enclosed, you'll find a typical form, FEMA 154 rapid screening procedure, as an example of what we propose to do. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Maybe not so much a question as a statement. I don't think anyone here on this committee disputes the need for the funding of these proposals or these two ballot measures, not ballot measures, the two laws. But we are, well, they were ballot measures. We are faced, as you know, with very difficult situation with our general fund. I just checked with staff, and as you know, this is not part of the governor's budget. We are instructed by co-chairs to reduce the governor's budget by at least 4%. So it's going to be difficult to initiate these programs in this biennium, I think, or the coming biennium. But it doesn't take away from the need statewide, particularly with many of the budget of the buildings we have that simply are not prepared to withstand any kind of an earthquake. So you are entered in the record. We'll put the information with us, and maybe the department can consider this type of thing should we have add-backs, because we are also instructed to not only have budgets for add-backs, but also should we fall into an even worse situation than we are today. And I can also tell you that the preliminary statements I am hearing are that we can expect another downturn or negative revenue projections for March, and who knows where May is. Now, that's preliminary, and we haven't seen the solid figures yet, but there's some indicators that we're not out of the state of Oregon's not out of the woods yet. So, does any other committee members have any questions? Testimony, Senator Duke.
Well, my question was going to be what's your revenue source, but now you've taken care of that, I understand. Have you considered putting together a bonding request that would be multi-year, which means that it would allow you to do the planning? Because I understand that the planning is doable in bonding, but we don't bond for $1 million. So allow you to do the planning and then go on do the retrofitting.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, have we considered that? We've had a lot of discussions about what different options are. I think we are looking for any good option. That is a very rational and reasonable option, and one that we'd like to flesh out. We've had some conversation with the Treasurer's Office. They're willing to help if we get to that point.
I'm not sure where the revenue comes from to
pay
the bonds.
And that's the interesting point. I mean,
eventually you're going to have a revenue stream, but I mean.
That's correct, and that's the problem. But, you know, we'd love to have a small bonding. I mean, these measures allow up to $600 million per measure, $1.2 billion in total. We have talked amongst ourselves of maybe jump-starting it with a $40 or $50 million bonding package and maybe doing some rural projects and getting some economic development out of this at the same time. You know, so there have been some creative thoughts. It keeps coming back to money.
Well, stay tuned, and if you have more information or we can help you with information, we'll certainly share that. But as I stated before, this is a very, very difficult position that the state of Oregon's in right now. So.
We're aware of that.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rich Angstrom.
Good Good afternoon. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I think it's always helpful whenever you get, when you folks are considering budgets, to hear from industry and how the industry has been working with the agencies on its behalf as you go through the budget process. It's been a pretty good year this year working with Dogama. We have quite a few projects out there that have been very successful. A rogue aggregate project that was one of the OEB projects that industry helped out on, and with ODOT and some other agencies that went through very well. Dogami was an instrumental part in putting that thing together and making it happen. Sometimes these big projects take a force of will for them to actually happen. You have to have somebody in the point that takes the responsibility on and pushes the project through. And in the case of the Rogue project, that person was Frank Schnitzer from Dogami that made that happen. It was very much appreciated by industry, and the end result was a benefit to not only that local community but the fish and wildlife resources down there on the road. Other projects that Dogami's been working with industry on is the confluence there in Eugene. We're looking at a reclamation project there that'll encompass all the operators from Eugene, Eggy, Delta, Sand and Gravel, Wildish. And that process has been, that particular program's been going on for since last session, and you folks might remember me talking about that during some of my presentations last year. That one's such a large project, I imagine it's going to take a little bit more time. Dogami does have a fee bill that they are moving forward that we hope, I talked with us Representative Krupp today, we hope that to get that out of committee and get it over to Ways and Means intact. The industry unanimously, after much debate on this issue, supported this the fee bill section one of it only, which is just for the next biennium. They had, within the bill, they had 5% increases for the next several biennium. The industry felt that that it's best to do it biennium at a time and review those issues from one session to the next. So section one we supported. We supported as far as their fee bill. Thought that was important to communicate to you folks.
Rich, are you talking about House Bill 2256?
I believe that's the number. Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure there wasn't two bills coming at us.
One of the things that...
I'm still amazed they've got a fee bill for one person. I mean, that's how tight this agency is.
This, and I like to... Chair Meserly, Senator Dukes, that's one of the points I'd like to make. This agency has four or five field staff persons, I believe it's five, that do between 1,500 and 1,600 inspections on aggregate sites throughout the state. They get more done for a small outfit than any other agency that I know of. Their field presence is very important to the industry. They're out there not only they're getting in front of problems before they happen, and as you know, in the world of aggregate, that's the best way of avoiding conflict is to try to get in front of the problems before they become too large. I don't know. I always hope. I'm a hopeful person. This next year, though, we expect several other projects to move forward in the interim. Not only field presence, not only continuing of their stormwater runoff program that they've worked out with the DEQ as far as assuming that program, but also an increased presence at Goal 5. And I did hear some of the discussion earlier about making sure they're not an advocate but an information source to help the decision makers, which is the local governments in this case, make sound decisions based on good science. And that's the role they play, and it's very necessary to have some a neutral body come in that forum and say, you know, here's the quantity, here's the quality, this is from a geology perspective, this is the process by which the industry or geologists would analyze those kinds of things. And it's very helpful to the local government decision makers then to help balance and figure out whether or not a site makes the quantity and quality aspects of the Goal 5 determination. But the big issue is that we want to make sure Dogami is staffed to the point that they can take on a project that we've now started discussions with their board. OCAPA sought a limitation under the Endangered Species Act and NOAA Fisheries 4D rules that they came out with a couple of years ago. And we were specifically named for future rulemaking by NOAA Fisheries. At that time, it was the National Marine Fisheries Service. I'm trying to use the right terminology here. And what we're hoping is that Dogami will be the lead agency in bringing together all the stakeholders and being able to come up with management practices that satisfies NOAA Fisheries so we can get a limitation under the ESA. What that will do in the long term will reduce not only Dogami's involvement in putting together sites and having to be involved with the long process working with NOAA Fisheries, but also it'll save the operators an immense amount of money if we can do it as a programmatic approach. So that's one of the projects we're hoping to move forward with Dogami this next year, and the fee bill, frankly, helps them be able to accomplish that. That's all I have. Any questions?
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Johnson.
If the fee bill is going to ultimately allow Dogami to be the lead agency and confer all this benefit on the industry, why then would you only support the fee bill for a year? It's a very modest fee.
Well, the view of our board is that we're hoping that that's only a two-year project to get that out. But the second thing is that on this particular fee bill, we worked with the agency for 18 months looking at their budgets, talking to them about the issues and what they have going on in their program. We think that's a healthy discussion, and we don't want to just give them a blank check from every year. So my board's preference is to do it on a biennial basis review. We'll entertain it again next session. Hopefully we'll have the same discussions with the agency, and if there's a need, we'd come in again and support it. If we didn't think there was a need, we'd come in and say that. Ultimately, it's your determination, but that's where our folks are at this point.
Any other questions? Committee?
Just a comment. I read this agency right. They're about one OREB grant short of losing personnel and being able to function. I share Representative Johnson's concerns. I am surprised. You used the term blank check. I don't think that's a term you could really use with this agency. And never mind with the fee bill we're talking about. Doesn't quite get to those numbers. So I am sort of surprised, too. I mean, if we want to look down the road to having an agency that can continue to function, and you need them to be able to do that, that perhaps at some point we need to give them some breathing room so that they don't spend half their administrative time trying to figure out how they're going to get through the next year.
Chair Messerly, Senator Dukes. Their proposal, it was their proposal to add one, and they felt that's what they needed to do the job. And we support them in that. If it takes more with more responsibility, we would come in and address that depending on, you know, how it worked out. Our folks, I appreciate what you're saying. One of the things that I think we all have to be sensitive to is that everybody's hurting out there. And for this industry to come out and say, okay, given the way the market is, we're losing, frankly, businesses are going out of business. You heard that only there's 400 quarries haven't produced any rock from the testimony. I know that I fully expect to see some bankruptcies happen. That the membership is so sensitive about fees and budgetary issues that this was the compromise that they all felt comfortable with, to bring in the whole industry in a unanimous vote for the fee bill. There were some folks that would have supported the entire thing, including the additional 5% in the future years. But in order to bring all of us on board, this is how we felt it was best to pull everybody together to do that.
Rich, I'm
I'm a little bit concerned because I agree that we've got some huge issues, as you and I know you're well aware. We've discussed it many times. The issue on the Umpqua River is one example, but there's others that are out of stream pits as well. That just a lot of issues with the Endangered Species Act and water quality. And it would seem to me that not only with this department, but also with DSL, that unless we support these programs, these departments, and make sure they're on track doing the work they're supposed to do. In DSL's situation, I'm a little concerned about that. But we have to have a solid program if we're going to go to the federal agencies and say that we're going to run this program and we're going to protect this, the issues that you're concerned about. And I'm just a little concerned that how can we do that unless we have a long-range plan of how we're going to fund it. So,
Chair Messer, that's the excellent point. And this will get us through this next biennium. I think next session, when we pick this issue up again, there's going to be a much more significant discussion about them being able to staff and look at 4D issues on an individual permit basis and pick up that kind of role. And that's going to require more time. But at this point, in order to get us there, they don't need more people. And depending on how that all takes shape and what form it works out in the negotiations with NIMS will dictate, you know, how this agency needs to evolve to address those future needs.
I guess my, and you don't need to respond to this, but I'm not sure how much time we have. We've got a lot of challenges coming at us from more than one federal agency, and we need to be ready to respond. Representative Johnson?
At the risk of piling on, I'm going to share the comments of both of my colleagues. You're painfully aware of the situation that has just concluded, I'm delighted to say, in Columbia County. And when I think of the magnitude of time and the breathtaking expense that took to resolve that, it seems to me that given Mr. Lynch's very graphic demonstration of the good work that can occur on the ground to head off problems, that this $35 increase seems de minimis in comparison to the literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in lawsuits that follow an unsuccessful resolution. And so I'm just trying to understand how, if you've got a program that has demonstrated efficacy and you're asking industry to contribute minimally to the continued success, why it is that there would be any objection to adequately funding a program that the industry seems to value.
Chair Messerly, Representative Johnson, I agree with you, but I think this is an adequate funding for this next biennium. I do think that this next go-around will have to look at the expanded role of DOGAMI. Don't forget that DOGAMI only handles the reclamation portion of mining, and that many other agencies have other portions of the mining. Overall mining complex, if you will. So when it just comes to the MLR side of things, it's the industry's belief that this is adequate for them to do their job and do a very good job.
Thank you.
We didn't get anything in print. Rich, do you have anything you can get to us or to us so we have it in our files?
I will type something up to mirror the testimony both that I've given here and in the Substantive Committee in Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pat West?
Chairman Messerly, members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I represent probably 98% of the paid firefighters in the state. So my whole purpose for being here is just to kind of make you realize how important, from our viewpoint, having these buildings surveyed and ultimately retrofitted so that they'll withstand earthquakes. Sitting in the back of the room, you know, kind of thinking of the whole picture, and in an emergency situation, how it tends to work is obviously we're the first responders, and if our buildings aren't able to withstand an earthquake, then we won't be the first responders. The second aspect of that is once you do get a cohesive plan where you're moving people, you know, to safety, typically what happens is the closest school is the area that people would go to have a safe haven, and then those that are injured are going to be going to the hospitals. So I was in the back of the room thinking, well, if we can't get the firefighters there because of an earthquake, the schools fall down because of an earthquake, and the hospitals, then we have a major problem.
It's called suicide.
And so all I am is a firefighter that was in a building in 93 when it was shaken, and we're running to try and get the apparatus outside before it falls down, although ours didn't, obviously. But it was a very interesting time, because all we were thinking about was getting the equipment out so that we would be able to respond to wherever we needed to. So it would have been too late had it been because it was done by the time we got into the equipment to move it.
So. I appreciate your concerns, and you heard my remarks earlier, I guess. We're in a very difficult situation, and we're just simply going to have to prioritize some of these expenditures. And I have to wonder, and knowing that you're right, we're not very well prepared, but how many warning shots do we need across the bow before we're able to move forward?
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, my closing comment would be that if it's impossible for you to come up with the funding this time, then anything you can do to get it to the add-back list or come up with the creative bonding that's necessary, we'd be willing to help.
Any other questions in the committee?
Thank you.
John, would you like to, do you have any more you'd like to present? Or we've got another 18 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've always been known to like to speak.
I guess I would, just off the top of my head, like to leave the committee with a couple of thoughts. I've been with this department a long time, maybe longer than some people would like. But I've observed it evolve from an agency with a ho-hum, poorly understood mission and poorly defended mission into one that has been reexamined many, many times by the legislature in terms of its responsibilities and in terms of the needs of the state. I've seen the agency trim some more, and trim some more, and I've watched the staff and the board struggle with the things that we're trying to resolve. We didn't create the problems in Oregon, but to a large extent, for the things that we deal with, the geology did. And it's simply our job to bring these issues to you and to state with the best science we have how relevant they are and how big they are and where they are, and to present options. And I would simply ask the subcommittee and the legislature in whatever way they can to not view this agency in terms of biases that may have developed 10, 20, or 30 years ago, and take a fresh look at the needs of this state and ask if you trust us to help you solve them. And if you do, we'd certainly be happy to work with you to find a way to do it. If it's small steps first, then that. If it's a larger step, then that. But I would especially encourage you that if you have any ambitions to work with us next biennium to solve some of these problems, do not destroy us this biennium. Thank you.
Thank you. Any requests, Senator Dukes?
Well, probably not the appropriate thing to follow his last statements, but I was just looking at your prioritized list, and I see one here that lists your five priorities and the general fund, other fund, federal funds, and the total. And I'm wondering if the ones that have of all of the above have general fund and the others, if not right now, but when you come back, we come to a work session, if we could get from the agency what happens if we were to reduce all or part of the general fund. I understand what
different sections do. I mean, at least I'm reading your little blurbs and it makes sense. So that's what that section does, and this is how much money that section costs us. But some of these have considerable federal funds in them, and I'm wondering if we partially reduce the general fund from there, would one of them still be able to keep going, whereas with another one, if we partially reduce the general fund, would we be destroying it? I don't know the inner balance in the different sections. So, you know, for example, geohazard assessments is number 5, so I'm assuming we can, you know, get rid of the general fund in there if worse comes to worse and we have to do something like that. Mm-hmm. And we're all hoping we don't.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
But it's still got, you know, $320,000 of federal funds in it, and so I guess we're not... I need a feel for... Because you have so many funding sources for each program, I need a feel for if we're reducing general funds, what we're doing to it. And also whether your ranking here means that you would rather have general funds reduced from that one, or whether in overall considerations what that section does is easier to live without than the others. Not that any of them are easy to live without.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the best way to approach that kind of question would be with a more rigorous discussion of the issues and the sections. I did provide you with a bulleted look at some of the sections of the agency, which is probably the best way to approach it. When I received the late-breaking instructions on the 100% list, it was kind of like, do it quick and do it ugly. Right. So that's what you got.
But between now and the work session, you'll have an opportunity.
We can do that now.
You don't want me making all those decisions, yeah. John, so yeah, you absolutely. Better. You need to provide some help.
Some of the core insights that went into that list and the other list, 10%, 30%, some of the material you have there is, what is the absolute core value of this department that has value for the state that can be found nowhere else? And it happens to be the niche value is that we understand the geology and the issues that it brings to the state, and secondly, the field presence is paramount. If those two things are in one's mind, one has to end up in the Portland office looking for the next cut. With regard to the geohazards, when the smoke clears in the governor's balanced budget, you will find that probably 3/4 or more of that particular section is already on soft money. So anything the legislature is going to do is going to be beyond that. The evolution that I foresee with the governor's budget possibly is that, okay, we have most people in Portland. Is there any way we can collapse functions there to somehow preserve some kind of capability? And the capability I see being preserved there with that option number 5 is that we still have the deputy director overseeing all the sections. I would simply load her up with a little bit of the contracting, and we would still have some collection of expertise there that could possibly move forward with some of the issues you just heard about. Which I did not bring those people here. They came on their own volition. It's difficult, and I would appreciate the opportunity and the time to work our way through just as many questions as you want to ask.
Okay, I'm just hoping that when we get to a work session, and does staff understand what I'm asking for?
I think so.
Okay, great. Then
yeah,
you can...
Absolutely. Right. These are tools to use to start such a discussion.
I think it might be appropriate, Senator Deuce, as I've told all the department heads that have come to my office and we discussed their coming budgets, that we will not pass out we will not go to work session without having a meeting with the co-chairs and the staff and make sure that the recommendations that come out, they can live with some choices. Although it might not be the most pleasant, not knowing exactly where we're going to end up, but that it will not be a surprise to the department and hopefully not to the committee members either. So, any other questions, comments? Do you have more you'd like to say?
Just Mr. Chair, members of the committee, may sound hard, we have enjoyed being here the last 2 days, and the level of questioning. Analysis to me has been very, very rewarding. Issues are out there on the table, and we're hoping to just continue to work together and find answers that work.
I appreciate that, and I want to thank you on behalf of the committee for supplying us with a great deal of information and making a good case. And I think you've come across, to at least my understanding, that for the amount of budget you have, you do an awful lot of work.
I do.
And I think there's an awful lot of, as you've made the point many times, you and your staff, that the problems that you prevent, at least you're trying to prevent, worth much, much more than what you are, the cost to your state. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn.